This is a talk given by Frank Ostasevsky on August 7th, 2013, with the title of Impermanence Makes Transformation Possible.
Good. Well, I know that Terry spoke with you a little bit about impermanence in the last session, and so I wanted to go a little, swim a little deeper in that water and see what we could understand together. I'm going to start with a quote by a woman by the name of Sally Tilsdale. And she says this. She says, as Buddhists, we work to accept the impermanence, the inevitable decay of the physical body. But it's not enough to accept it as a fact. We can believe in this as something true, but we still don't want it in plain sight. That's good, huh? Isn't that good? Nagarjuna, a great Buddhist teacher, said, change makes all things possible. It's only because there's change that suffering can come to an end. Yeah. So a sound comes, like the sound of my voice right now, and then it's gone. Thought arises in your mind. It quickly passes. Sights, tastes, touch, smell, all of them, impermanent, fleeting, ephemeral. Yeah. Where's yesterday? And where did your childhood go? Yeah. If we want to understand death, we just have to look and see how this moment is continuously being born and dying. Everyone, every moment. The sound of my voice, the last sentence I spoke, it died. And we all died with it. In the Parinirvana Sutta, the final teaching of the Buddha, he says, all things, all mental formations are conditioned by change and characterized by disappearance and instability. Everything in this life is precarious. Nothing is secure. Yeah? Now, when you hear that, and especially when I read it so dramatically, it creates a little anxiety for us. You know, it's like, wait a minute, what are you saying to me? There's nothing I can count on? Nothing is solid and secure? You know, we try our best, you know, even though we might understand that intellectually, like Sally was saying, we start trying to manipulate our experience to have it the way we want it, yeah? Like, you know how it is in the morning when you wake up, and it's like a cold morning maybe particularly, and you're in bed and you're under the covers, under the, you know, your favorite down comforter, you know? And it's so cozy, right? And you just love it, and it's great. It's like, oh, life is perfect. Oh, what are they talking about, suffering and unsatisfactoriness? Life is good, you know? Ah, just like this. And then you have to pee, you know? And you try not to for a while, you know, you pretend, you know, I can put this off a little bit longer, you know. But then you get out of bed and you run to the toilet, you know, and you pee. And then you run back into bed and get all the covers back all over again, right? Trying to get the conditions back that you had that were just perfect, you know. But they're gone now, you know. And so we're always playing this sort of game with ourselves, trying to fool ourselves, really. And in a way, we're quite effective at it. We can certainly manipulate certain conditions to bring us some degree of happiness. But there's no lasting satisfaction in experiences, in these kind of temporary experiences, this kind of fruitless effort to stop the world from turning. So when the intention of those kinds of activities are to try and stop or step outside this law of impermanence, we suffer. And we don't just do this with external things, like, you know, trying to get the right relationship or the right house or some such thing. But we do it with our internally as well. We try to create some illusion of stability of ourselves. You know, some self-image, for example. I call it my life's movie, you know, that I just play sometimes. I just keep playing it, like, as if it were real. And then, you know, having created this sense of self and this life movie, then I have to extend this incredible effort to defend it and protect it and, you know, watch over my creation, you know. But the actual experience of our life, the visceral experience of our life, is changing sights, changing smells, changing sensations, changing tastes, changing thoughts. When you look, do you see anything else? So change is at the very heart of our lives, the very nature of our lives. And simply put, when we resist this, we suffer. When we resist this, we get stress. So it's not enough just to appreciate the impermanence in things. We have to understand how a misperception of this creates stress, creates suffering, creates dukkha. Yeah? And I think Terry spoke a little bit to that. And then beyond that, we also have to look and see how the truth of impermanence fundamentally changes our sense of self. And this dramatically changes who we believe ourselves to be. And in that we begin to understand something about no self or selflessness or boundlessness of our nature. There's a wonderful monk teacher. His name is Thanissara Bhikkhu, and I was reading his work on impermanence. And one of the things he was talking about was how the Buddha's wisdom about what goes into the production of happiness is really important to consider. Because we want to be happy, right? So, you know, one of the things that the Buddha looked at was that these efforts to produce happiness are only worthwhile if this process of change can be skillfully managed in such a way that we arrive at a happiness that's resistant to change. That's what the Buddha was teaching. About a happiness that's resistant to change. Thanissara says, if you don't understand this, then what you're doing is, what we are then are lifelong prisoners in a forced labor camp, compelled to keep producing pleasurable experiences to assuage our hunger, and yet finding them so empty of any real essence that they never really leave us full. That's what he says. And he goes on, to give his teaching about a question that the Buddha asked, which can lead us to a kind of profound insight, and I wanted to share it with you and make it the heart of our discussion tonight. The Buddha said something like this. He said, when I do it, will lead to long-term well-being and happiness? What, when I do it, will lead to long-term well-being and happiness? That's the question, right? And it's a really good question. It's a, you know, heartfelt question, a motivating question. And the desire for conscious action, actually. And to attain a pleasure that's worthy of all this effort that we've been going to. So I want to take this question in two parts. The first part is, he says, what, when I do it, will lead to? And so he's really focusing on the action, like what action we take, right? So this focuses on generating or on production and the potential effects of human action. He doesn't say give up, you know, it's no use, forget it, it's, you know, you're... He says, okay, look and see, how can you consciously use your human action in the service of happiness? And so what the Buddha did, if you remember the story, was he went into the wilderness, you know. And he went into the wilderness really to look at this issue, to see how far human action could go and whether it could lead to a dimension that was beyond the reach of change. That's what the Buddha was doing, really. And then we have the story of his awakening, which is a kind of confirmation that, yes, there is an action that can lead to a dimension that's beyond the reach of change. And this requires a certain skillfulness, of course. And so the Buddha laid out this really, you know, he was always laying out these very skillful means, these skillful paths. And he laid out the skillful path, and he said there were four types of actions that produce pleasant, unpleasant, and mixed experiences. Within the cycle of space and time, he said. And then there's a fourth that leads beyond action to a level of happiness that transcends space and time, eliminating the need to produce any further happiness. Okay, now I know that sounds like a lot of words, but what the distinction he's making here is we are continually in this activity of fabricating experiences to bring us happiness. And he's not saying that that's wrong. It's not a moral judgment against it. He's saying there is also the possibility of taking human actions that lead you to a place that's beyond this need to keep generating pleasurable experiences. Like if you just sit here right now, like you're listening to me, right, in this present moment, and there's a kind of activity in that. And what's happening, even as we're listening and as I'm speaking, actually, there's a kind of fabrication going on. We're producing something. And we're producing something that's based on the raw material of our past actions. In other words, we think this will lead us in this direction, so we do it. And we do that not only in activities, but we do it in our sense of identity. We keep propping up a sense of Frank or a sense of, you know, whoever we take ourselves to be. So that's the activity that's going on all the time. That we're always producing these kinds of experiences, right? At the same time, we're also consuming all these experiences. We're consuming them, trying to find any pleasure in what we've produced. And in that process, we often even gobble down painful things in an effort to try and find pleasure. Tanisara says, with every moment, there is production and consumption, and they're intertwined. We consume experiences as we produce them, and we produce them as we consume them. That's the cycle that's going on all the time. Okay, I want to talk about the second part of this, of the Buddha's question, which was really important. He said, basically, that will go to my long-term well-being and happiness. And so Tanisara says that what the Buddha is doing here is he's giving us a kind of gauge. He's basically giving us a kind of standard to say, this is how you look at pleasure. This is how you look at pleasure. Is it going to support or contribute to my long-term well-being and happiness? So in the old Pali word, the word that's used is sukha. Sukha is the same name as Lyndon Jim's dog. And if you go see sukha, you'll understand a lot more about this than if you just listen to my teaching. But sukha means pleasure and happiness, ease, bliss, actually. So what the Buddha is saying is that when you apply this standard to the experiences that we consume, if they aren't conducive to long-term happiness, no matter how pleasant they aren't true happiness. And if they're not true happiness, there's no reason to claim them as mine. That's the thing about my long-time well-being and happiness. He's saying, They don't lead to long-term happiness. Why claim them as yours? Just see them as passing activity. So the way we can kind of look at this or discover this is we take the microscope of the three characteristics, you know, constant change, stress or suffering, and no self, right? And we look at everything through those. And we see exactly how fabricated experiences are inconstant or impermanent. That they're stressful. They can be stressful because they're ending, right? Some even if they bring us pleasure, they end. And that they're impersonal by their very nature. And when we begin to see this, we're less inclined to keep trying to produce them and consume them as a means of getting happy. And when this realization deepens, really deepens, it gives rise to a certain kind of dispassion for fabricated experiences. And what the teachings say is then we're on the path that's leading to what they used to call the deathless. The pleasure or happiness that's not limited by space and time, and not limited by change. This is really important. He's pointing us to something that's beyond change. Okay. These three characteristics that I just mentioned, it's important to see them not just as abstractions, as abstract statements about existence, but as a kind of inducement for mastering the skills that will guide us along the path of insight, along the path to this freedom from constant change. Now, when people talk about impermanence, usually what happens is there's a kind of misunderstanding that happens. It is, everything's impermanent, so we should milk everything for all the joy we can get out of it. And again, I'm not wanting to pass a moral standard here, but Thanissaro's pointing us to another possibility. He's saying, getting the most out of constant change doesn't mean milking them for all their intensity, the experiences for all their intensity. It means learning to approach pleasure and pain, and see them, use them as a tool for waking up. Yeah, that's really how we get the most out of those experiences. So this is the alternative to suffering all the time, basically. And instead of trying to avoid the truth of constant change and living in constant conflict with it, we begin to really understand it. We take it as a kind of friend, as a partner, as a guide, actually. And we learn to live in deep harmony with it, actually. Instead of always trying to create solid things, like solid relationships and a solid world in which we try to hold on to what's familiar. And we can't do that, you know. We have to let go into the actual truth of change, of the changing experience. So when we do this, as we do this, what happens is our practice opens and our understanding and experience of impermanence deepens. And we go beyond just some kind of intellectual grasp of impermanence. And it takes us into direct contact with the temporariness of our life and with those we love. And then we come into deep appreciation for what we have. And as the mindfulness establishes itself and the concentration gets more developed, we can really look through this lens and examine our lives even more carefully. And under the constant attention to the present moment, our life dissolves into these fleeting moments of sense perceptions and change. And we see what they call in the text, the dissolving of rapidity. We just see continuous change. We see the stream of events instead of the way we've patched it together in a continuous movie. Okay, I want to make a few more points and then we'll stop. When we see things, like today I was sitting and I was just watching things unfold, basically, just watching things unfold. And, you know, I kept looking and seeing if I could find some steady, unchanging me, Frank. And I couldn't. I couldn't find anything at all. And I came into this kind of emptiness. And I thought to myself, wow, what have I been so busy protecting? Nothing. Nothing. That's what I found there, nothing. Doesn't mean, it's not nihilist. It doesn't mean that my life doesn't exist or it's not worthwhile. It's that we've lived in a kind of confusion. We've been so aligned with the activities, with the fabrications of our life, that we forgot the space that they're moving through. You know, so the image that's given all the time is, of course, that of the clouds moving through the sky. We've kind of identified ourselves as clouds, and we forgot about the sky. And the sky's not subject to this constant change. It's just there. It's just open. All right, one final comment, and then we'll stop. Most of the way that we relate to impermanence is as the experience of loss. Things come, and then they change, and they're gone. That's mostly how we relate to it. That's how we talk about it a lot. We acquire things, and then they change. We have it all together, and then we don't. We find love, the love of our life, and then she goes away, you know. But the law of impermanence isn't just the law of loss. In the text, it's called the law of change and becoming. And there are two sort of correlated laws which provide a kind of balance. So there isn't just constant dissolving. There's constant becoming. And it's useful to place our attention on that aspect of the law, not just the dissolving, but on the becoming. And to examine it really closely. There's another wonderful Theravada monk, and he says, nothing is but is becoming. Nothing is but is becoming. So he's saying nothing is solid, but it's constantly becoming. Today when I was sitting, I was just watching this constant unfolding. And when I stopped trying to manage it, it became fascinating. It was absolutely fascinating to watch all this, you know, for awareness to just witness all of this becoming. And I thought to myself, wow, awareness really needs a body. That's what I was thinking, because I thought, oh, awareness is knowing through my eyes, through my nose, through my ears, etc. And so it felt very personal. You know, it wasn't some abstract thing. It was very, very personal. And there was a feeling of beauty and ease with it as it was showing us. These things were showing themselves to me. Or revealing themselves in awareness is a better way to say it. And then as I sat there, I had this feeling of like, oh, awareness isn't limited to just my eyes and my ears and my nose. Awareness can know through all things. It can know through your eyes and noses. Yeah? So, and I thought, oh, when I think I'm only this, it's very personal and it's very beautiful. But when I recognize myself to be that awareness, then I know, oh, then it's actually possible to know through all things. Nothing is but is becoming. He's pointing to a kind of appreciation of this ever-fresh unfolding moment. That we're born again and again and again, not separate from everything else in the universe, but a manifestation of it. And at times for me, when I feel really stuck and calcified into my sense of self, it's helpful to reflect on a reality that each moment we have literally new brain cells, you know, with which we think, new eyes, with which an ear, with which we hear and see. Each inhale, like even right now, you just think about each inhale and exhale, totally different than any other inhale or exhale that you've ever had. That's an extraordinary experience of constant transformation. We can completely rely on this truth. And it makes me curious about how I can know something that's not subject to change. And I can know that, I believe I can know that, through studying the law of impermanence, studying the law of constant dissolving and becoming. So I think I want to stop here and just ask you one question, and then we can have a kind of dialogue. When you have a painful experience in your body, some cramp or physical pain, and it dissolves, aren't you happy that there's impermanence? Yeah. Yeah. But then when some pleasurable or joyful experience comes, and it dissolves, we get angry at impermanence. Yeah. So we can't have it both ways. One of the things that I'd like to orient us to is to notice not just that things dissolve and the sense of loss that sometimes accompanies that, but then to notice what else is there. In other words, what's the experience of this thing dissolving? Besides loss, or in addition to loss? Is there an ease there? Is there some kind of quiet there? Is there some stillness? In other words, to really begin to look and see what happens when something dissolves. And you know, what do you notice in that space? And what do you notice about how the next thing becomes? How the next thing emerges? That's really important to see both sides of this equation. Okay? So I'm going to stop my formal comments here and turn off this recording.